Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In the fall of 2015, artist Gaylord Shanilek and writer Terry Tempest Williams ventured into southern Utah's desert and returned to the studio with juniper and sandstone of artifacts from the author's land. Gaylord Shanilek built and proofed printed blocks from the found elements, and around and through these images, Terry Tempest Williams shaped her text. The result is Oracle Bones, a handmade book featuring poems by Terry Tempest Williams and woodblock prints by Gaylord Shanilek, published by University of Utah's Red Butte Press. Gaylord Shanilek will headline an event at the Logan Library on Monday. That's at 7 p.m. That event is presented by the Friends of the Logan Library, and everyone is invited. We'll be talking with artist Gaylord Shanilek today on the program following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In the fall of 2015, artist Gaylord Shanilek and writer Terry Tempest Williams ventured into southern Utah's desert and returned to the studio with juniper and sandstone artifacts from the author's land. Gaylord Shanilek built and proofed printing blocks from the found elements, and around and through these images, Terry Tempest Williams shaped her text. The result is Oracle Bones. It's a handmade book featuring poems by Terry Tempest Williams and woodblock prints by Gaylord Shanilek. It's published by University of Utah's Red Butte Press. Gaylord Shanilek will headline an event at the Logan Library. That's this coming Monday, 7 p.m. The event is presented by Friends of the Logan Library, and everyone is invited to that event. Again, that's at the Logan Library, Monday, 7 p.m. We welcome in artist Gaylord Shanilek. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. Are you in Wisconsin? Is that where you are?
I am in the wilds of western Wisconsin.
Western Wisconsin. You grew up in North Dakota, I understand.
I did.
We'll get into all of that a little bit later. I want to jump into the into this book. It's a fascinating book. Oracle Bones is the title. So how does project come about? Somebody called you and said, hey, do you want to collaborate with Terry Tempest Williams? Is that how it happened?
Not exactly. I was at a gathering of the Ladies of Letterpress down in Iowa, teaching a workshop, and Marnie Powers Torrey from the University of Utah was also there teaching a workshop. And we got to know each other a little bit, and she came up with the idea of getting Terry and I together to work on a project.
And this is the result, this is a fascinating book. So then, as I mentioned in the intro there, fall of 2015, I guess you then traveled to the southeastern Utah area to Terry Tempest Williams' land there, and you guys went out into the desert?
Well, actually, there were two trips. I drove my pickup out there the first time and spent a few days down there myself, down around Moab, out in the desert, and then a couple months later, Marnie invited me back, and then I spent a weekend with Terry and Brooke, her husband, and a group of Terry's graduate students from the Environmental Studies Project at the university.
So tell me about those trips. How were they, and tell me about your process. What were you looking for?
Well, I mean, when this came up, I mean, I had never been to Utah. I'd never thought of going to Utah. I'd never been in a desert, so it was a completely different environment for me. And the first time I went, it was just me and my pickup truck. And I mean, I'm a flatlander, so when I'm around these vertical shapes that you find down in the desert down there, that's what's really striking visually. But more than that, it's just a whole different atmosphere with a whole different set of plants and history.
What struck you first is that, you know, you come from flat land. This is vertical land. What else struck you?
The colors of the slick rock and the rock faces, just that beautiful purplish blue and red and the visual effects from the weathering of these stones through the years. And of course, all the artifacts of other civilizations are just all over the place down there.
Terry Tempest Williams has said she was struck by the fact that you did see this, I guess, in her mind accurately. We refer to it as red rock, but it's more, it gives off a more purple affect.
Yeah. Purple and red. I mean, there's red there too, for sure.
Yeah. So what did you, I guess you were looking for physical objects. That's what you make your prints from?
Yeah, I do. I print from anything that I can machine down to the same height as letterpress type, because the machinery I use is letterpress machinery. And I'm able to, I have a big bandsaw. I can saw, well, I can't saw stone, but I can certainly saw wood, but I can sand stone down to the same height as the metal type. So it's a very physical process. Machining down the surface to the same height as the type, applying ink to it, and then printing it on paper by hand.
So, what did you come out of the desert with to use for this book? It was stone, and then what wood? What did you pick up?
Well, first of all, I noticed these signs. I camped out the second night in the BLM land out there, the public land, the federally owned land, and there's a sign that threatens you with a $250,000 fine and years in jail if you mess around with the antiquities. But I had my pickup, and when I got back to Wisconsin, I had a piece of juniper which I found next to the road. I think it was probably a discarded fence post, and a couple of pieces of the sandstone.
And I think later on you went out onto the Brook and Terry's land.
Yeah, we did that second time I went.
Yeah, where there's no $250,000 fine for that.
Right.
So yeah, tell me about your process. You have stone, you have wood, and then you said you if you can get it to a certain thickness, then you can work with it.
Yeah. And I have a neighbor that has a sawmill, so a lot of the sawing he does, but I do have a big bandsaw, so I can saw the wood myself here. And I have a drum sander. It's a very accurate drum sander. And like when I'm printing letterpress, a thousandth of an inch is sort of the thickness that you're dealing with in terms of getting things to print well. And so I'm able to sand these blocks very precisely down to the same height as the type.
Then what it was take wood, for example. What do you do with that? You have I guess certain colors that they're printing that pattern of that wood and then you sequence through colors. Tell me about that process.
Well, in theory, each color requires a second block, another block. So you cut one block and then you transfer what you've cut onto the surface of a blank block. So then you can see where everything was in the first block. And then you can cut the second colors because you can see the location of everything. But sometimes, if it's really complicated, there's something called a reduction cut where you take that first block, you print the whole edition. And then you cut away some more from that same block and you print in a second color from the same block, which it's a lot easier because then you don't have to redo everything. But on the other hand, you're cannibalizing the block so you can never print with it again.
So you have to plan it out carefully, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. No, it takes a lot of planning, a lot of drawings, a lot of proofs, a lot of like I'll cut three or four different color blocks and proof them all in a number of different shades of different colors just to get some idea of where I'm going. But the more you do this, I mean, I've been at it for 45 years, the more you're able to sort of anticipate what might happen. But there's still, you just never know. I mean, you do have to go through the process anyway.
Tell me about the difference between wood cuts and wood engraving. You do wood engraving, I think, or do you
Well,
do both?
I do both, but I'm primarily known as a wood engraver. But I do a fair amount of wood cuts as well. But with a wood cut, you're cutting into the plank side of the board, so you're either cutting with the grain or against the grain. Whereas with a wood engraving, you're cutting into the end grain of the wood, so you're cutting into all the little tips of the cells of the wood. So great precision is possible. Plus, with wood engraving, you're using tools that were devised for steel engraving. So, I mean, think money, think that kind of precision is possible with those tools. So, with a wood engraving, much more precision is possible than with a wood cut.
Yeah, interesting. I guess you do your wood engravings, your other on stone as well. You do these, and then there's a whole book design team that takes it from there. Is that what happens?
Well, in this case, in the case of the book that Terry and I did together, the Red Butte Press folks had the book for 10 years. Terry and I were together for one weekend, basically. And so they actually worked on this thing for 10 years. And really, the essence of this kind of work is the time spent focused on what you're doing. And so they spent 10 years taking, there's one poem of Terry's, and there were maybe five or six blocks that I made and sent them. And they spent 10 years kind of creating this space between the boards of the book, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, that is remarkable. A lot of care goes into this. Kind of a throwback, right? This is an old art.
It's totally a throwback, but it's so important in today's world with this thing that we all carry around in our pockets, which has become the thing that we communicate with this world and the digital world with. Whereas with work like this, you're just dealing with the present world and your hands and your eyes and your mind and time.
You obviously live in both worlds. So what do you think we lose when we go, totally digital, which is, a lot of us just live in the digital world.
Well, I know. A good example, this morning I was making a schedule for a medical appointment for my wife, which had been canceled, and to try and deal with a health system, and you go through all these phone trees, and it's so hard to get a hold of a real person to talk to. Well, it's kind of that sort of thing, I think. It's a whole different world that it's hard for me anyway. I use it just to sort of keep in touch with people and things, but I try to spend as little time as possible there.
So you're working with physical objects, obviously. That's your art, that's your career. What does that do for you?
Well, I don't know. It keeps me busy.
Yeah. Yeah, very, very good. Yeah. So the result, I don't know, were you surprised with what the team came up with this? They worked on it for 10 years. It's a very beautiful book.
It is a very beautiful book. And I was surprised by the fact that it was a horizontal landscape book. Being a flatlander like I am, like I was saying earlier, the verticality is the thing that always sort of catches my attention. And when I originally made the blocks, I proofed them and I sent them to Marnie along with a mock-up of how I thought the book should look like. And it was a vertical book. So the horizontal aspect of it was a surprise. But like I was saying earlier, the 10 years that they spent creating this space between the covers was pretty remarkable.
So you thought it should be a vertical book. In other words, what?
I did. Most of the books, I mean, I work with a lot of different people, bookbinders and paper marplers and paper makers and writers, but usually I'm in charge, I make the decisions. And so it's really refreshing actually to be in a situation where I'm not in that position. Somebody else is actually making the decisions.
So a vertical book would be tall and narrow. Is that what you're talking about? And this one is bound on the short end. And okay.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a horizontal book.
Yeah.
Format.
So you did say there was an event at University of Utah earlier this year, the launch of the book. You said this, you've quote unquote collaborated many times, but you felt like this was your first true collaboration.
It was, cause it was 10 years ago. I have since done a true collaboration or two, but it was sort of a wake up call. Yeah.
So collaboration in the sense that there's equal input from everybody. And as you said, you don't know how it's going to turn out.
Yeah, and I'm not the one in charge. Well, I don't know how it's going to turn out when I'm just working on my own either. I mean, you have a rough idea of where you want to go, but from the beginning to the end, if you knew where you're going, there'd be no point in going there.
Yeah, I could. There's a thrill in that, right? But also, I could imagine it'd be a little nerve-wracking if you don't know exactly. But I guess emphasize the thrill. You don't know. That's part of the adventure.
Well, it is, and isn't that what creative work is all about? I mean, you don't know where you're going.
Yeah, I guess so.
And the longer you're at it, the more of a sense you have of what you're capable of and of just the sort of more physical aspects of what you do, but you don't know where you're going. I don't know where I'm going from one book to the next, that's for sure. Each one is sort of a leap into the unknown.
Yeah, tell me about that leap. I heard you use that phrase at this panel discussion I've been referring to, leap into the unknown. You're leaping from one project to the next.
Yeah, but you don't know where you're going to end up. For instance, there was one project I did on a widening of the Mississippi River up here in Wisconsin, and I spent 7 years at it. And the project began with buying an old boat and converting it into a floating studio and just setting off on the river and seeing where it would take me. And I spent 7 years letting the river sort of dictate the direction.
That sounds fascinating. Tell me a little bit more about that. You did, for this project, you bought a boat and kind of changed your life in a bit that way for 7 years.
Oh, it certainly did. And it sort of relates back to the collaborative things. So I spent 7 years on this boat out on the river, working on this book. And at the end of those 7 years, I kind of came to the realization that I was a man alone in a boat. And the next project I did, which was about, it actually started, the Minnesota Historical Society Press decided to publish a children's book about this waterfall that had traveled from present-day downtown Minneapolis, downtown St. Paul, to downtown Minneapolis. And it took 12,000 years for this waterfall to move that distance. And there's a children's book author, John Coy, who wrote the story of the waterfall's journey from the waterfall's perspective. And that was a 5-year project, and they hired me to, or they asked me to illustrate the book, and they offered me a small advance in royalties, and you know, it was going to be 5 years, so I had them agree that I could produce a volume of my own, or an edition of my own, and so that's how I kind of managed to finance the 5 years. But we had, I think we had over 24 people involved over those 7 years. We had, it started out with 2 interns, and eventually one of the interns became the person in charge of arranging other interns to come in. And in the end, rather than just being my book, we had probably, there were 6 of us in partnership, and we all got part of the proceeds in the end. And because I had to keep these people around for 5 years. So that was a real collaborative effort there. I had to make the final decisions, but I really didn't have that much to do with the direction that things went.
How do you think things were doing? Maybe the end product. How do you think the end product was different versus you being totally in charge, or maybe you being the only one involved?
Well, I can think of one little instance. There was this place called Spirit Island, which was on the Minneapolis side, and the Army Corps of Engineers, they got rid of the island to make way for a lock and dam there. And so that was kind of a big part of the story. And we came up with this image, but it was one of the interns that actually put together all the proofs of the block into the final composition. And I'm sorry to say, I can't even remember her name now. But that sort of thing, where I didn't really have anything to do with the composing of the image. But in the end, I guess I sort of got credit for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fascinating. It's time for a brief break. Let's take a brief break here. We're talking with artist Gaylord Schanelek, and you can find him at midnightpapersales.com. It's Gaylord Schanelek's website. You can see many of, not all of his projects there. Very fascinating range of projects. We're talking this part of the program about Oracle Bones. It's a handmade book featuring poems by Terry Tempest Williams and woodblock prints by Gaylord Schanelek. It's published by University of Utah's Red Butte Press. And Gaylord Schanelek will be headlining an event at the Logan Library on Monday at 7 p.m. Everyone's invited. This event is presented by Friends of Logan Library. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In 2015, artist Gaylord Schanelek and writer Terry Tempest Williams went into southern Utah's desert, returned to the studio with juniper and sandstone artifacts from the author's land, and Gaylord Schanelek built and proved printing blocks from the found elements. And around it, through these images, Terry Tempest Williams shaped her text. The result is a book, Oracle Bones. It's a handmade book featuring poems by Terry Tempest Williams and woodblock prints by Gaylord Chanelik. That's published by University of Utah's Red Butte Press. And we're talking with the artist today. Gaylord Chanelik will headline an event at the Logan Library. That's on Monday, 7 p.m. It's free and open to the public, and the event is presented by Friends of the Logan Library. So, Gaylord Chanelik, a couple more questions on those Oracle Bones, then I want to dive into your very interesting biography. So this is the result of that extraordinary team taking 10 years on this care on this book. But they said they wanted to include plant material in the pages. So they used kind of some more usual material, but they also included yucca and sage. And then for the print, they used the ephedra plant, sometimes known as Mormon tea. They created dye, so they used that. A lot of care, as we've been saying, went into this book.
Hello?
Yes. Do we have you? Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah.
Okay. So I was just giving that example of the native materials went into the pages of the book. A native material goes into the dye. I guess that's it's an extraordinary book.
Yes, it is.
So I guess one more thing on the book, just to comment on this, the team, they made the book out of two different materials. So the imagery on translucent Japanese paper called Goyu, text on a heavier machine-made paper called Pasha. And so the result is you have to push down on the page to read the text. That's an incredible idea.
Yeah.
That's out and available now, Oracle Bones, Terry Tempest Williams and Gaylord Chanelik. So I want to get into your biography a little bit, Gaylord Chanelik. So you grew up in Fargo, North Dakota. I understand that you wanted to be a poet originally.
Right. Well, actually, I ended up, by the time I was in high school, I was in Fargo. But up until that point, I was way up in the northeastern corner of the state, little town called Cavalier.
Oh, how small? Pretty small.
Yeah. Well, we had a hospital.
Okay.
We had a hospital in a post office.
So you were up there, and by high school you were down in Fargo. Apparently, you had a chance to meet American poet Thomas McGrath, who's, I didn't know this, he's North Dakotan.
Oh, did you know of Thomas McGrath?
I knew of him, but I didn't know he's North Dakotan. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yes, he is a North Dakotan. And when I was a sophomore in high school, I took this modern poetry class just kind of on a whim. And McGrath was one of the guests one day. He came into the class and it just totally changed my life. I was so impressed by the guy that I just fell in love with poetry. And when I went off to the university, it was with the idea of becoming a poet like Tom. But I soon learned I lacked the courage for that occupation. And when I finished with school, I moved to Minneapolis. And my connections were in the literary world, so I sort of fell into trying to be a small press illustrator. And eventually I got a printing press and kind of went on from there into making books. So my background really is a literary background.
Yeah. That's interesting. You say you lack the courage to be a poet. What do you mean there?
Well, I mean, it's very, very hard to make a living as a poet. I mean, to teach and get into academia, I mean, I've known poets that have died in poverty because they just, I mean, there's no money in it. Same way with the musician, for the most part. And the work that I do is so all-consuming that I learned pretty early on, if I couldn't make money at it, I couldn't do it. So the books that I make are very limited. They're all handmade. At this point, they're very expensive. And a large part of the audience are special collections librarians around the country and around the world, actually. And so that's kind of, in terms of money making, that's kind of the audience that you have to at least be aware of when you're doing what I do.
Now, I'm guessing maybe you didn't know all that when you started out. It's kind of a leap, as you want to say.
It was a leap. It's been a lot of leaps, yes.
Yeah. So what did you, what you drew you to, you thought, well, maybe I could be an illustrator of books. What were your first steps there?
Well, for me, the appeal in poetry was always imagery and the juxtaposition of imagery in the lines of a poem. And so when I started illustrating small press poetry, I sort of followed that same formula. I would find images in the poetry and sort of juxtapose them in the images with the poems. And so in a way, I was still in the same, not the same process, but sort of the same basic framework of the juxtaposition of images and what that creates. That's sort of the thing that I was the most interested in, that you don't really know until you put those two images together and then something just kind of appears.
Yeah, there's a magic in that, isn't there? Yeah.
There is a magic. And you know what? That's one thing that Terry liked to talk about the desert, the mystical side of things in the desert. And that's something Terry and I really had in common, I think.
So what were your original forms? Did you leap immediately to wood engraving? What were you doing early on?
Well, initially I was using a rapidograph pen, and before long I found myself using the finest point possible, a 000, and painstakingly trying to control the space between each dot. I was using dots in the drawing. And so I was into this precision thing. And then when I discovered wood engraving and I found that I could use the same equipment that I could use for printing type in the words, well, it just made perfect sense that I would move in that direction because I had that precision thing in me.
So you're jumping into this cold, I think, right? You've wanted to be a poet. You've decided I'm going to be an illustrator. Did you have a background in art?
Well, I went to the university with the, initially I was in the English department, and once I realized that I didn't have the, like, I couldn't read my poems in front of an audience. I just didn't have that in me, so I could kind of hide out in the art department. So that, I went to the art department from there. And then, like I said, when I got out of school and moved to Minneapolis, my connections were literary, so it just kind of all naturally fell into place.
By the way, I understand one of your early books is an homage to Thomas McGrath. Tracking the Moon.
Is that the name of it?
Yeah, that's what I'm reading. published
no,
in 1981. Did they get it wrong?
I'm trying to think of what the title of that book was. It was called On Returning.
Oh, okay.
And it was a poem that I wrote. In which I claim to have learned to recognize Thomas McGrath's footprints in the snow. And I sent him a copy, and it's just a little book. And he wrote back and he said, thank you for the mysterious, beautiful and mysterious little book. And that was that until after he died. I was looking through his last book of poems called Death Songs, and I found a poem that read, warning, so you've learned to recognize my footprint, but don't think that you know which way I've gone.
That seems to be a message to you.
I do believe it was.
Yeah. Well, that's quite the accomplishment to get a message like that from Thomas McGrath. Yeah.
Yeah, and to actually recognize it.
Yeah.
A couple years ago.
Yeah. Now I love this story of how the name of your press came to be Midnight Paper Sales. In fact, that's how you find Gaylord Channel, like midnightpapersales.com. Tell me that story.
Well, I guess around 1980, I was living in a warehouse in St. Paul with a bunch of other young artists and writers. And across the alley, there was a paper company with a loading dock. And on the loading dock were these bins that they would fill with offcuts of paper when they, you know, custom cut paper. And we used to go there after dark and root through to get our printing paper. And that's my friend Gary Yeager actually came up with the term midnight paper sales, but I just loved it and I kept it. And all along, the moon has become, it's an image that I use every chance I get in images that I make. And it's sort of the It's not a logo, but it's sort of, I use it all the time in conjunction with my press. And it kind of goes back to Tom McGrath. One of my favorite McGrath lines is, "And the moon stuck in my pocket." The muse, once the muse gets you, it's like you're just kind of, you don't have any choice anymore. You just have to follow it.
So you've had all kinds of projects. You did several of them connected with water, right? You mentioned this project 5 or 7 years. You're on a boat. There's a is this connected with this? There's a construction demolition of the old high bridge in St. Paul,
right?
And you did a project to around that.
I did, and I you know I mean the Mississippi River. Where I am here, it pretty much dictates the landscape. And so I've always, I don't know, it seems to come up with me a lot because it's here, the river. And in North Dakota, it was the Tongue River, which is this little tiny river. And then in Fargo, there was the Red River. So I've kind of progressively gone from a small little river up until I finally ended up at the Mississippi River. So yeah, the river has been definitely a flow through in my life. But I think that there's been a series of books where natural history, just the natural world, has been the thing that I have sort of focused on.
I was reading this quickly, but there was, you had one project where you went out into a forest and I got samples from many of the trees. I can't remember what that one was called.
It was called Silva. It was a study of the trees in our 27 acres of Wisconsin woods. A young man named Benjamin Verhoeven, or young at that time, he just graduated from Rhode Island School of Design. And he came by, his uncle brought him by, and he was full of youthful energy and enthusiasm, and he'd never seen a letterpress shop before, and he was fascinated. So he stayed on for a six-month internship, which led into a Silva. Part of the internship was for him to produce something of his own, and his dream was to produce a Silva, but given the limitation in time, he focused on a single tree, a cottonwood tree, 12 rows into a cornfield. And I thought if I could get him to stick around a while longer, maybe we could produce this full-scale Silva, this study of trees, and he agreed, and so we spent 5 years together working on that.
You've had a couple of other books based on natural history as well, as I understand it. Lac des Pleurs is another one.
Yeah, that's the Mississippi River
Mississippi book. River book, yeah. And then Mayflies of the Driftless Region. You're going small. You're looking at insects under a microscope, are you?
Yes, Mayflies of the Driftless Region. That started with a book that I had seen when I was in England, actually, by F.M. Halford about fly fishing around the turn of the 20th century. And I fell in love with the images because it seemed to me they were about as true to their subject as they could be. And so the idea of at least attempting to satisfy science occurred to me.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Yeah.
And so from then on, I mean, the natural world has been a huge part of my interest in things. And lately, I met a woman named Beth Witherell a few years ago, she's like the editor-in-chief of Princeton University's project of publishing all of Henry David Thoreau's unpublished works. And we hit it off, and she started sending me links about things that she was working on. And she suggested that next time I was in New York, I go to the Morgan Library, which houses the phenological charts that Thoreau was working on when he died. He was 8 years into this project of chronicling the natural cycles of his Concord home. And so I decided to sort of do sort of a parallel to that with my Wisconsin woods. And so I'm about 3 years into that. But when you read Thoreau's journals, you're bombarded with quotes all the way back from ancient Greece, all the way to contemporaries of his like Charles Darwin. So he was getting all his information from books, whereas I'm getting all my information from my phone. And when my phone identifies a plant for me, the program I have on my iPhone is wrong maybe 30% of the time. So that's kind of what I'm fascinated with right now is the fallibility of this thing that we depend so much for our information.
Yeah, so you said about 30% of the time.
Yeah, I think that's about right. I had a residency in the Florida Everglades last summer, and the first evening I'm out there with my phone and I take a picture of a bird in a tree, and my phone identified it as a penguin.
Yeah, which is probably not going to be correct.
No.
Well, let's go to a break, and then we do have someone who's called in to make a comment. We'll go to break so I can fix the technology, hopefully, so that you'll be able to hear this blending phone with Zoom. So we're talking on this program today with artist Gaylord Shanilek. He, along with Terry Tempest Williams, are authors of a book. He did the art for it, and she did the poetry. It's called Oracle Bones, and that's published by University of Utah's Red Butte Press. Gaylord Shanilek is headlining an event at the Logan Library on Monday. Everyone is invited. Monday, 7 p.m., the event is presented by the Friends of Logan Library. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with artist Gaylord Shanilek. He, along with writer Terry Tempest Williams, have produced a book. It's called Oracle Bones, a handmade book featuring poems by Terry Tempest Williams and woodblock prints by Gaylord Shanilek. That's published by University of Utah's Red Butte Press. Gaylord Shanilek will be headlining an event at the Logan Library on Monday at 7 p.m. Everyone's invited. That event presented by Friends of the Logan Library. So, Gaylord Shanilek, we do have a caller on the line, and hopefully we'll set things up so you and Carl can actually hear each other. Carl has called in. Carl, go ahead with your comment.
Thank you, Tom. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I've been listening to you for about 45 minutes, and I don't know whether I'm naive or dumb or what, but I still do not know what your guest does. Tom, now he comes down to southern Utah with Terry Tempest Williams and picks up some artifacts. Now, I interpret that to mean some colored rocks and maybe some petrified wood and driftwood or whatever, and then takes it back and, for lack of a better word, whittles or carves these stones and this wood into what? What? How does he use those? It's grainy. Sandstone is very grainy and sloughs off easy. And then living up in the wilds up there where it's winter about 11 months of the year, and these long spaces of time for 10 and 15 years, how on earth do you make a living? This has got to be time-consuming and very expensive, and you travel around. Has an uncle left you millions of dollars, or do you sell millions of books? How do you sustain yourself? And really, what is it that you do? I just don't understand that, to make a living.
Okay, thanks, Carl. That's a good question. Gaylord, were you able to hear the question?
I heard the call.
Good, good. Okay, our technology worked there. So, further explanation is in order. Probably Carl represents some other listeners as well.
Right. Well, Carl, I make books by hand, and it is very time-consuming process. Now, at this point, and especially like when I visit with students and their teachers at universities, attention span is a big problem because everybody's getting used to immediate gratification because of this thing in their pockets that everybody's carrying around. Whereas the work that I do and people like me takes a long time, and it's a very hands-on process. But there's a real interest in the libraries of this country and around the world in the physical book because of this thing that we carry in our pockets, because it takes much more sensory effort and time to read a book than it does to look at your phone. And so there's sort of an industry that has grown among special collections librarians and very serious book collectors that value what we do, especially in comparison to the way things have gone in the digital world that we live in now. So the books that I make are very expensive at this point. Most of them are. And over the years, more and more, the basic audience has been special collections librarians who then make these books available to students mostly, although you could go, say, to the University of Utah and go to their special collections, and you could see some of this work there, I'm pretty sure. So it's all about time, Carl, really. It's about the time spent, and somehow you got to make it pay so you can keep doing the work.
Maybe explain a little more, for Carl's sake and all of our sakes, what your process. So you get a piece of wood, for example, and how does that end up in the book? How does it look in a book once you're done with that process?
Okay, you take a piece of wood, and either I carve into it or I just let the wood speak for itself, but I put it on a press, and I put a thin layer of ink on it, and when I press that block with the thin layer of ink onto paper, I get an impression from the surface of that wood. I mean, a photograph is once removed from the actual object, whereas when you put ink on this surface and you print from it, it's absolutely directly an impression of that surface. So, I mean, wood grain knots, cracks, any sort of personality that the wood has shows itself on the paper once it's printed. And any cutting that I do, any engraving or anything, that too shows up. So it's one print at a time, printed by hand, on very good paper. And the paper is, I mean, pretty much for 30 years, I was pretty much working with Western paper, like handmade papers. And maybe about 10 years ago, I started headed east and started using more and more Japanese papers. And it's a whole new world with them. I mean, just the paper itself has a huge effect on what's going on when you're printing.
Yeah, it's a whole art, isn't it, for the Japanese, I guess, all papermakers as well. I don't know if that helps, Carl. Does that explain?
It does. I have one more question, though. May I ask it?
Sure. We just got a couple minutes left. Go ahead.
Okay. My question is, if I was to buy one of your books, what's the range of money that I would pay for the books that you put on the market?
Oh, you could spend anywhere from $100 to, actually, I recently sold the deluxe copy of the wood book, the Silva book, for I think it was $36,000. That's kind of on the secondary market, but I mean, especially some of the bigger, earlier books that are very rare have gotten very expensive for sure.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. It's interesting.
Thanks, Carl. Appreciate that.
Thanks, right. Carl.
Yeah. Just got about a minute or two left, Gaylord Shanlick. What's your latest project?
Well, right now I'm kind of working on the Everglades thing, and I'm in the middle of printing it. And I've got a book fair coming up in Miami in February, and I need to have at least enough of an idea to show people when I'm there back in Florida so I can sell a few copies. So, but you know, I mean, I just kind of go through the day. The best day for me is one where the day just takes me wherever it wants to take me. Mm-hmm. So I print, I write, I talk to you, I go out to the wood shop and do stuff out there. I go out in the woods. It's a good life.
It sounds like it. Yes. And thanks for including us for an hour here. Appreciate it. So Gaylord Shanlick is headlining an event at the Logan Library. He'll be in Logan. You can interact with him. That's on Monday. It's coming Monday, 7 p.m. The event is presented by the Friends of Logan Library. Everyone's invited. Again, that's Logan Library, Monday, 7 p.m. Gaylord Shanlick will be there. The book is out, Oracle Bones, a handmade book featuring poems by Terry Tempest Williams and woodblock prints by Gaylord Shanlick, published by University of Utah's Red Butte Press. And you can find Gaylord Shanlick at midnightpapersales.com, midnightpapersales.com. Gaylord Shanlick, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Thank you. We'll go out as we do on Thursdays with Leo T. and Skywatcher. Thanks, everybody.
It's One Sky, Many Cultures, Skywatcher, Leo T. Lots going on, a little bit of roar action going on if you're in Northern Europe and maybe across the Midwest up in the higher regions there. And, of course, the comet out there. But NASA launched Europa Clipper to explore the ocean moon's possibilities of life. Big spacecraft lifted off Tuesday on the SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket, embarking on a nearly six-year journey to Jupiter. The Clipper set sail after necessary delays and began its 1.8 billion mile trek to Jupiter, thus kicking off a highly anticipated astrobiology mission to the Jupiter ocean moon Europa. With its sails literally unfurled as the Europa Clipper deployed its enormous groundbreaking solar arrays, this amazing mission joins NASA's Psyche asteroid probe, which we've been talking about. That was the first interplanetary spacecraft to fly atop a Falcon Heavy, and that was launched about a year ago, October 13th, 2023. Now, the Europa mission required full use of the rocket's central core, as it needed all the power the Falcon Heavy could manage to send it to outer space on its way to Jupiter. And of course, lots of space viewing action from right here in good old humble Earth with the comet in action, as well as the northern lights across the upper Midwest in Canada and northern Europe. Comet visible right here in the Rocky Mountains about 45 minutes after sunset between Venus and Arcturus, and up a little higher each night through the weekend to the left. Yes, storm predictions and storms are here, but have you noticed that usually below the clouds at sundown, with a little luck, there are many times clear sky. If you miss it, you can catch it again in another 80,000 years, though. When the comet last came, Neanderthals, mammoths, saber-toothed tigers roamed the Earth. So check it out. The comet's visible for about an hour and 40 minutes after coming into vision. I was able to see it earlier in the week and have encountered about four other folks who have seen the streak in the sky. Check the comet's setting times at Stellarium Web for times that are accurate to your exact location, and keep an eye on NOAA's 30-minute forecast. NOAA's the main go-to weather forecaster for decades. It's One Sky, Many Cultures, and from her book, The Woman, the Wolf, and the Wilderness, Teresa Simu Martino relates her unique situation. Intro and poem about her heritage read here by Arielle Gully. So raise a wolf.
A fascinating and true story of a wolf's return to the wilderness. 6 years ago, Teresa Simu Martino helped a young gray wolf return to her homeland in the northern mountains of the Pacific Northwest. As the two made their journey, which took months to accomplish, Martino underwent her own personal transformation. She discovered the richness and strength of her mixed blood ancestry, Osage and Italian. Martino's roots, particularly as Osage, guided her in the dangerous and unpredictable journey of returning the wolf, Mackenzie, to the wilderness. In the process, Martino found her own wilderness. Original poetry and line drawings by the author help tell this adventure story of both body and soul. On the paths through the woods, hunting with the wolves, another me walks. My hair grows longer, and I do not tie it up. The blackberry bushes take hairs from me that I suppose the birds will use later. Walking slowly and watching carefully, I think of the deer and their narrow slotted hooves. Step, pause. Step, breathe. Look. Don't slap at the twigs that grab and poke. Stroke them aside, and soon they dance with my movements and gracefully let me pass. The little wolf does these things naturally. For the Osage. Call me up, stars. Call me up, stars. You star people, call me. Call me up, but slowly, slowly. Call up my spirit first, star ones. Call up my mind next, stars. Call up my body last, and I'll dance with you, dance the white road way. You star people, call me up.
So raise a wolf. Look up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T. Thank you.